So we said this evening we talk about clinging to self, and just to begin, maybe I'd repeat a little of what I said this morning in the instructions. Somebody came to the Buddha once and said, "I'm very busy. I don't have time to sit and practice for a long time. I don't have time to hang out with you and the monks. I don't have time to learn all your rules. Just explain to me clearly in one line what is the essence of your teaching. I don't have time for the rest." Must have been a Westerner. And the Buddha said, "Nothing whatsoever should be clung to as I, me, or mine." It's one way of translating the Pali. The other way of translating is, nothing in this world is worth clinging to as I, me, or mine. So, like yesterday, we're exploring this clinging not as some kind of intellectual exercise, but because of the relationship between clinging and suffering. And that's always the reason for this kind of exploration. Otherwise, it's just mental gymnastics. Nothing in this world, nothing at all, we could say, is worth clinging to as I, as me, as mine. And we looked a little bit at last night at this idea of clinging to I. In Tomei's example, I couldn't think of an example. Tomei said, "I'm smart." And the way in which the pressure to maintain, as soon as we define ourselves in some way, the maintaining of that, the building it up, fear of losing that status, or whatever it is. And we mentioned brief just the example of the way we relate to ourselves bodily, in terms of age, beauty, physical kind of attractiveness or physical ability and capacity, and the amount of incredible pressure that people feel in that whole area to be attractive, to be thin, etc. The French are the worst, I must say, at this. I live in France. If you go to a pharmacy in France, 30% of the whole pharmacy is taken up with things to be thin. With minceur, it's called in French. Mince. It sounds very unattractive to be mince. In English, mince is this kind of chewed up meat that you put through a machine to make it all kind of... And in France, that means attractively thin. Suffering in life doesn't come from being one shape or another. It comes from clinging to an image of the body. Clinging to I should be a certain way. So as I say, we kind of touched on that last night. But just to see how much we define ourselves in terms of our body, in terms of what I look like, what I want to look like, what others will think of me and what I look like. And all that is just in the realms of ideas. It's so, if we start to investigate, if we scratch at the surface of our rigid ideas, it's so obviously a fiction. I say, "Oh, I'm this kind of a guy. I'm however many, however tall I am. I don't even know how tall I am. I'm however tall. I'm this, I'm that." But it's just, you don't see that it's just a blip in time. We've taken like a snapshot of a moment of existence and interpreted it in a certain way. If that was true, I am 1.80 meters. How do I reconcile that with that picture I've got of me at 3 years old and I'm this tall? Is that the same I? Or is it a different I? If it's the same one, how do I possibly account for the fact that it can be 1.80 meters and 1.00 meters. Can one thing be two things? Can I be 1.80 meters and 1 meter? If I cut my hair, am I a bit less than I was before? But we define ourselves again and again and again in terms of who I am in that way. all the pressure that goes into maintaining it, and it doesn't take much, it just doesn't stand up under any kind of critical analysis. Again, to emphasize, the critical analysis is not for the point of an analyzing itself, but rather to introduce some doubt into this fixed view I have of who I am. And therefore, because of the clinging to this fixed view, the suffering that's there as a result. Nothing is worth clinging to as I, as me, or as mine. Not clinging to me. Just do we see how that works? As soon as the sense I have of me immediately gives me a you. Me and you. Me and other. Us and them. Think how much dukkha in this world is as a result of clinging to an idea of us and them. Every war that was ever fought is because of clinging to me and you, to self and other, to us and them. And the result of clinging to a sense of me, of clinging to anything at all as me, is isolation or loneliness or separation. I see there's the whole universe stretching out infinitely, we're told, limitlessly in every direction. And right in the middle of it, me. The whole universe, everywhere around, full of all kinds of things, people, trees, deserts, everything, all around. And one extra thing that's looking out at all the whole universe, me. Extraordinary joke. And all the more extraordinary that I'm so convinced of it, and yet you're so convinced of it that you're the middle of it, and you're so convinced that you're the middle of it. We're all so convinced that we're each one of us the thing that's looking out from the middle of the universe at the universe all around us. Nonsense. Has to be. Nothing, says the Buddha, nothing in this world is worth clinging to as I or me or mine. Whatever we find to define as me. So sometimes the kind of the idea of we're all one. But that's also very suspect. If all this is me, is there some agony in me every time a tree is felled or something changes in the world? Anything, any way we define a me is problematic. So the Buddha says nothing is worth clinging to as I or me or mine. And clinging to a sense of mine, just maybe just over these days in retreat, all the dukkha that's been there because of my dot dot dot, my history, my practice, my pain, my lunch, my shower, my skin under the sun, my. How many times a day does that word run through our brain? My whatever. We fill our lives up with I, me and mine. Clinging to ideas that under not too much real scrutiny show themselves, at least this kind of mental scrutiny, show themselves to be at best flaky ideas, shaky ideas. And we blindly, on we go. I, me, mine, I, me, mine. And then we think somehow life treated us unfairly because we were suffering. So the Buddha says, for goodness sake, I don't know what that is in Pali, I don't think he quite said that, but the Buddha says, pay attention. The device of meditation is designed, is invented, is cultivated in order to pay attention to this. To this problematic mechanism of identifying with whatever it might be, of identifying with body, of identifying with feelings, of identifying with perceptions, of identifying with mental states, of identifying with consciousness, and saying, this is who I am. This body, this mind, this is who I am. Meditation is a device for looking closely at that mechanism in order to understand well enough how it works and what's faulty about it. If we see how it works, if we see the clinging inherent in it, we see, ow, that hurts. We see the responsibility of this, as if we're carrying this great weight that we're clutching tightly for years and years and years. And someone says to us, keeps saying to us, put down your burden, because they can see we're kind of struggling under it. Put down your burden. And we've been going on for so long, we forgot. Like somebody who's been wearing their glasses so long, they're looking for them, and they're already on their head, you know? And so meditation's trying to stop us and get us to look and notice the burden we're carrying. If we notice we're carrying a burden, naturally, if we notice we're carrying a burden that's unhelpful and unnecessary, naturally, we'd let go. So with clear seeing. If we really see what's helpful and what's unhelpful, if we really see, naturally, the response of the mind is to let go. It's like sometimes when we may be sitting and someone says, oh, just relax. So, okay, I'm relaxed. And they say, what about your shoulders? Oh, yeah. We feel, oh, I'm relaxed. And we don't notice. But as soon as our attention, it goes there, once we realize our shoulders are tense, we don't have to think, oh, right, shoulders tense, what to do. Once the attention goes there, once this clear seeing is there, we know that it's helpful to let them go. We see that it's unnecessary. We see that there's tension. Let go. This is clinging. This is freedom. Pali word for not self is anatta, and along with the old chestnut about suffering yesterday, it's one of the other most misunderstood teachings of the Buddha. And Buddhists are even proud to that they've got this extra special religion, because everyone else's religion has got teachings about God and that kind of thing, but they've got something much better. There's no self in Buddhism. No one else has got that, have they? Buddha never said there's no self. And it's kind of touted as this great Buddhist kind of calling card. And Buddha said nothing in this world should be regarded, should be clung to as I, me or mine. He also said, nothing in the entire universe has any inherent self-existence. I'll explain what I mean by this, and why this is different. Nothing we can find, nothing we can point to, nothing we can isolate, nothing we can smell, taste, touch, see, did I say that? Conceive of, think about, has inherent self-existence. Do you understand at least the words of that? Inherent means basic or fundamental or complete. Self, existence, being. Nothing can be by itself, would be another word to say that. Huh? Once when the Buddha was asked directly, is there self or not? He refused to answer. Because either would be an extreme view. So the Buddha, this is where the Buddha is genius, is there. Some would say genius, some would say trickiness, or worming his way out of clear answer. But the Buddha said there's four types of questions, or questions should be responded to in four different types of ways. First way is yes or no, clear answer. Second way is by exploring and interpreting the question. Third way is by asking another question back to the questioner. And fourth way is putting the question aside. And there's a kind of famous list that the Buddha says of questions that should be put aside and not dealt with, just not gotten into, because the result will just be confusion. Some things he said it's impossible to know. And some of those things were the complexities of karma, for example. It's impossible to fathom, to comprehend the complexities of karma, should be put aside. What happens to an enlightened being after death? That's another one. He says, well, why do you trouble your head with this stuff? Put it aside. How deep can meditation go? So it's impossible to know. It's impossible to find how deep meditation can go. Put it aside. Is there self or isn't there self? And the Buddha says, goodness, you people are complicated. Put it aside. So why does he say to put it aside? One of the other area, we're talking about these areas for clinging, right, yesterday, clinging to wanting, clinging to views and opinions. The other main area the Buddha talks about is clinging to being and non-being. I'll explain what I mean. So, same self, there is a self, or there is not a self. There is a self, something is, and we're not talking in a vague way, we're talking in a precise way. To posit that something is, that something has self. And when we talk about something, it can be anything. Everything shares the same nature. So it doesn't really matter at all if I'm talking about me, or if I'm talking about a tree, or if I'm talking about this bell. Everything shares the same nature. Do I have a self, or don't I? Is there self, or isn't there self? The Buddha says, you suffer when you cling to ideas of being or not being. Because either is problematic. If I say this bell is. This is a bell, period. Never mind all this Buddhist complexity, this is a bell. We can say it, but the problem is if we cling to that as being true. This is what we mean by clinging, huh? Not clinging just in terms of hanging on, but actually believing that that's the truth of things. When we talk about clinging to self, clinging to I, clinging to me, clinging to mine. It's believing that that is the real truth of things. If we believe that this is a bell, and habitually we do, huh? We say a bell, and we treat it as this independent, solid object. When we lose it, we say, oh, what happened to my bell? My bell. Huh? if we cling to self in the bell here, this is a bell, we lose the rest of the universe. Huh? Bell. Where's the rest of the universe gone? Bell. We can't separate. Just like I was saying at lunch, no? About the appreciation for lunch. The work, the growing, the washing, the transporting, the kitchen preparation, the carrying. But of course you can look endlessly. The sun that shone on the vegetables, the water, etc., etc., etc. Same with this bell. The metal that was mined, the person that poured the cast, and then as soon as you have a person that poured the cast, you've got the family of the person that poured the cast to support him, and the ancestors, and this and that. And it's not just ideas. This bell couldn't possibly be here without the participation of every other thing in the universe. So when I say bell, and I isolate it from everything else in the universe, and I cling to that as being true, I have to be on the wrong track. So Buddhists recognize this, and that's why they're so chuffed about their teaching of no self. No? Oh, we know there's no real bell. The whole universe is involved. No self, no bell. When you say there's no bell, you lose the bell. When you say there is a bell, you lose the rest of the universe. When you say there's no bell, you reclaim the universe, but you lose the bell. Buddha says, nothing is worth clinging to as I or me or mine. Mine includes everything. My bell. My, even if it's not my bell, it might be your bell, but I'm seeing it. It's my perception of the bell. For goodness sake, Buddha says, don't get stuck in being or not being. That means, forget the bell. It's my bell anyway. You don't need to worry about it. The Buddha says, then, if I conceive of myself as being something solid and fixed, that me I was talking about in the rest of the universe, everything out there and me, I'm bound to suffer. It's such a responsibility. Isn't it? The whole universe to deal with. I've got all my own problems, my pain, my this, my that, that I was mentioning earlier. And I've to be responsible for all those interactions, all the things that happen to me, all the things that I do. It's a huge burden. No wonder we worry so much. We're responsible for the whole universe and my place in it. So wonder we've got this far at all without cracking up. But if we say, oh, it's not me, we discover Buddhism, we say, ah, there's no self. It's just conditions coming and going. Okay, it's conditions coming and going. Okay, it's true. We look and see there's something beautiful and profound in looking as deeply and closely as we can at our being and seeing that we can't find anything in there that we can really hand on our heart and say, this is me. Body is very unreliable. It's changing all the time. How can it be me? And the same with all the mental phenomena, changing all the time. The thought life does a pretty good job of persuading us that it's me, that it's I. But what can we say about ourselves apart from the thought about us? You follow that? Where do we get any evidence for self-existence from? Apart from thought. Because thought itself isn't me. How can it be? I have one thought. I'm smart. We'll take one from yesterday. I'm smart. Where was I before the thought I'm smart? And where am I after the thought I'm smart disappeared into the vapor? What tells me I'm smart apart from the thought I'm smart? You see? Thought keeps the illusion going. We keep producing these thoughts. Almost every thought has I in it. Think the meditation is just full of I thoughts. I wonder what I wonder. I, how can I? Should I? Why haven't I? Oh, my, me. We're completely caught up with I, me and mine. And the ongoing momentum of it is what does the job of convincing us, because it's happening often very fast. And yet, sometimes in meditation, that process can slow down and we start to notice the gaps between the thoughts. Thought comes and goes, and there's a silence in between. In that silence, how can there be self? In that silence, we say, I've stopped thinking. In the silence before that thought, I've stopped thinking. Okay. But as soon as we come up with, I've stopped thinking, we're back into the realms of I. We've clung again so fast. I've stopped thinking. But where's the I without the thought of I? Where is the I without the thought of I, without the I thought? Where is it? Don't imagine an answer, but look for it. Look for I. Look as hard as you can. Look for I without the I thought, apart from the I thought, prior to the I thought, or after the I thought. Can't be found. I can't be found apart from the thought of I. So nothing in this world is worth clinging to as I, as me, or as mine. If you find yourself confused or wondering why this is necessary to talk about, because this is the heart of the matter. Huh? It's not just wordy stuff. It's pointing to the very crux of our experience and the very fulcrum. Fulcrum, you understand? The axis. Axis, you understand? Tzir. This is the very tzir around which our midpoint. It's the around which, yes, around which our suffering turns. This is the axle on which the wheel of samsara spins. Clinging to self, believing in being or non-being. I am or I'm not. I am this, I'm not that. I am now, I might not be later. Clinging to life, fearing death. So this investigation is the heart of the matter between where we suffer and where we discover freedom of being. But we can't force the issue. So if you notice, if there's an engagement with that process, if we close to the I thought, it's really worth exploring this matter. It will be the most fruitful activity we can engage in as a human being for our own benefit, well-being, ease, and freedom. And the greatest use that we can be of to others. But doesn't help to just to engage in just in terms of a lot of thinking about. So I'll offer an alternative teaching for tonight, which is teaching of one of my first meditation teachers in Thailand, Pandu Sadi. It's a short teaching. He said, breathe in, smile. Breathe out, relax. And then he'd leave the meditation on. That was it. Very nice. So when the mind is sharp and the passion is awakened and the intensity and the faith and all the faculties for Dharma practice are burning to understand, investigate this issue of self. Look closely, because it's the juice. And when mind is confused and the energy is not there and it all feels like hard work and the body's aching, breathe in and smile. Breathe out. Relax. Okay, enough. May all beings be liberated from being and non-being.
male beings live with wisdom and kindness. Male beings live a free and happy life.